From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, two brothers convicted of a murder they didn't commit.
It's an out-of-body experience, especially for an innocent man to be sentenced to natural life in the state penitentiary without the possibility of parole.
Mid-Michigan police and communities of color building new mutual understanding.
Beginning to understand that we're all connected, that there's a oneness of humankind, so to speak, and if we acknowledge that, that we're all part of one family, then that helps us down the road in terms of racial healing.
Preserving your family photos, letters, tapes, recordings that could inspire future generations.
Documentaries or the basis for novels or films in the future, the stories that happened to people in the past are frequently the springboard for future creativity.
But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Two brothers from Wayne County, Tommy and Raymond Hires, served 26 years for a murder they did not commit.
Well, each day was pure hell. Pure hell knowing that you're innocent and you're still there, but you have to adapt to your situation to survive, to keep your sanity.
Now exonerated and free, the brothers could each get $50,000 for every year in prison under the state's new compensation law. We'll talk with the Hires brothers about their story later this hour. But first, the mistrust and misconceptions between police and the minority communities they serve run both ways. And that's why the Michigan State University Police Department is hosting a communication session that brings together community leaders and citizens with police officers from all over mid-Michigan. The idea? Examine prejudices held by communities against police and those held by police against members of minority communities. MSU Police Sergeant Florine McLaughlin-Taylor is organizing this session. She's with us now along with Ken Pounds. He's a minister. He served as chaplain at Star Commonwealth's Albion campus for 40 years, and he's a trainer in racial healing. Welcome to both of you.
Well, it's good to be here.
Thank you.
Sergeant, this year's event that MSU PD is hosting, it came out of a racial healing conference that you put on last year. What did you hear from people then that made you realize, you know what, we need more of this?
Well, one of the things dealt with the evaluations that we received in terms of their comments, and individuals indicated that they wish they had had more time to talk more about this. And in particular, they were very interested in the history of policing and also the historical aspect of race and discrimination and how it came about.
Give us an idea who will be coming to this session.
Anyone in terms of its faculty, staff, we may have some graduate students attending. There's community members. There's individuals from religious organizations. So it's an open event for the public. We have several police agencies that are taking part. Last year, we had the Lansing Police Department, Bath Township, Meridian Township, East Lansing, but they were all local agencies, including Michigan State Police. And all of those have been invited back this year as well.
Ken, that term racial healing, what does that mean to you?
Well, to me, it means that one of the things that we're exposed to is the works of a man by the name of Nathan Rutstein, who has passed on, but he viewed racism as a disease, and his whole approach was that if racism is a disease that we're all infected with, then there's a way of curing it. So racial healing is a way of approaching that. If we're infected with the disease, then the cure is us beginning to understand that we're all connected, that there's a oneness of humankind, so to speak, and if we acknowledge that, that we're all part of one family, then that helps us down the road in terms of racial healing.
Sergeant Taylor, as you work as a police officer, how do you think the public misunderstands officers?
I think any time the public comes into contact with the police, especially on a traffic stop, the assumption many times is that they've done something wrong, when in fact it could be just to warn them, to let them know, for instance, that it could be an equipment failure, but something to keep them safe. So there are those types of misunderstandings. And most of our contacts, traffic stops, that's generally the issue. So what we've been doing as well is we've been training our officers in terms of non-escalation, where we try to lower the tension when coming into contact with the public, meaning that if we make a traffic stop stating who we are, the reason why we stopped you, and just indicating, again, that reason up front, not asking, do you know why we stopped you? And that tends to lower the tension immediately.
And Ken Ponce, what's the flip side of that? What are the misconceptions that you find that officers have about people in minority communities?
Well, I think throughout the history of our country, there's been a criminalization of people of color, particularly men of color. And I think that's something that many police officers, that's their operating position, is that this person is potentially dangerous. And so you go into a mode of confrontation instead of a mode of, let's see what's going on here. Is there a better way we can approach this? Is this the way we can de-escalate the situation without it becoming confrontational? And I think that's part of what the struggle is when you hear about some of the things that happen between police and members of the minority community.
Certainly with the advent of cell phone cameras and, you know, able to shoot video, that has certainly come into the spotlight in our nation. But there really is, you're going to be talking about the history of policing in our country that really contributes to institutional racism and tensions. Can you give us a little sense of what you're going to share about this history?
Well, one of the things we're going to share is just about how policing came about in the United States. There's two roads, if you will, that it took. One was more out of from the north in terms of, as policing developed, it was used as a way to, you know, kind of keep people in check, if you will, to bust up unions, to contain riots that would occur occasionally between people. And then out of the south, policing came out of the slave patrols. And so those kind of paths kind of merged at some point in time. And basically what has happened is that police find themselves in a position of having to maintain a system which keeps people in check, whether it's, let's say, people who are involved in unions, let's say, for example, or people of color who the system has labeled as being criminal, and these folks have to be controlled. So I think in many ways the police find themselves as gatekeepers, if you will, of a system that they are being asked to help keep in place.
I'd like to say that a lot of times when officers or an individual is stopped by an officer, many times individuals of color feel that that is the reason why they're stopped. So the perception is it wasn't necessarily because there was something that they did wrong, or it was something that they did wrong, but mainly because they were a person of color. And so that's what we're trying to dispel and have conversations about in terms of this workshop.
And as a woman of color who is a devoted police officer, how do you personally process that history?
Well, one of the reasons why I became a police officer was because I felt that there weren't enough, women of color in law enforcement. And being a female, being a black female, I think it's important to be here, to work with individuals and be a part of that history. But a lot of it was interesting to me as well in terms of processing it. A lot of the information that was shared at the workshop last year was new to me, just like it was to some of the other individuals there.
Ken, what are some of the ways that you can help both of these groups do a better job of understanding each other? I mean, to take that very first step of admitting, okay, maybe I need to make some changes in the way I'm thinking about them.
Well, that's a very good question. One of the things that Sergeant Taylor and I really worked on was just this whole idea of, let's have a conversation. And with the understanding that the purpose of the conversation is not necessarily to convince people of their position, of each other's position, but it's to have a conversation about, we don't have to agree, but let's at least listen to each other. And as we listen to each other, then hopefully people begin to really hear or get at the feelings behind people's statements. And once you get at those feelings, then that takes you to a different level. and you're more open to at least becoming curious as to why people respond the way they respond. Why do police officers do what they do? Why does the community sometimes respond the way it does to police officers? If you get curious about that, then that opens up a pathway to not only connecting with the person, but hopefully to understanding where they're coming from.
Sergeant Taylor, can the session that you're going to be doing April 24th be used as a template for other regions of Michigan?
Definitely. I think we need to have more of these conversations, and I think the more often police and the community come together, the better the understanding will be, and a lot of the misconceptions, and bringing about better understanding as to why we do the types of things we do. And I think it would be beneficial and can be used as a template.
This is to both of you, and I'll start with you, Ken Pons. How will you measure success of this day of communication?
Well, I would measure it success if people really obviously are conversing with one another, but not just conversing, but are people listening to each other? Are they allowing people to say what's on their minds or in their hearts? Are they allowing people to speak that? Are they really being open to the feelings behind what people are saying? And to me, that would be successful. But for me as a facilitator, you're always looking for that light bulb, if you will, that you can see that goes on within people when they really are beginning to hear what the other person's saying.
What about you, Sergeant Taylor? What's success to you?
I think Ken summed it up very well, but I think just from having the session last year and people indicating that they wanted to continue that conversation shows me that not only was it successful last year, but this is a good thing that we're doing again this year.
Ken Pons, minister and facilitator in racial healing, who has worked with youth at Star Commonwealth's Albion campus. He's now founded a business called One Day, and its mission is to promote racial equity. And Florine McLaughlin-Taylor, a sergeant with the Michigan State University Police Department. I want to thank both of you very much for sharing this mission with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, tips and tools to save and preserve your dusty photos or digital files and why it matters. Then in 10 minutes, he struggled in school. Now he helps connect teachers, parents, and students through an instant messaging app. We'll talk to the co-founder of Remind. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Your grandparents' wedding pictures, the letters your dad wrote home as he served in World War II, your great-grandfather's citizenship papers, all of these are precious links to our history. And history is less about the big names and more about what happens to everyday men, women, and children. But how many of us know how to preserve these historic treasures, whether digital or on ancient paper? With us now is the head of preservation and conservation at the University of Michigan Library. Shannon Zachary, welcome.
Good to be here.
So we all have these treasures tucked into albums or boxes or some digital form, and I'm going to bet most of us don't understand the best ways to preserve them.
Tucking things away can be okay for many things. There's such a thing as benign neglect if you're talking about ancient paper. Not such a good idea if you're talking about that cassette recording or your digital photos or other things, because those are actually very fragile.
I think most of us who live our digital lives now and the baby pictures are up on Facebook or maybe they've got those last emails that they got from an aging parent, I think we have this perception that digital is pretty durable.
It can be very durable, but it does require some work up front. You want to make sure that you're choosing a file format that is stable and long-lasting. A lot of cameras have their own digital formats, proprietary formats that come and go very rapidly. If the software becomes obsolete, if the hardware needed to use it becomes obsolete, it could be gone. It could be gone very quickly.
And I think a lot of people get careless about that simple backing things up.
Back it up. Absolutely. You need to have it in at least two locations, if possible, on two or even better, three different types of hardware. The cloud could be one type of hardware, A hard drive could be another, and your computer or your phone could be another. So you've got three copies in two different locations. So if something fails, you've got it backed up. And with luck, things won't all fail at the same time.
Because I'm just thinking of my iPhone. I have, the better part, over 8,000 photos on my iPhone because I love looking at them. I guess they're in the cloud, but I think many of us who are civilians are just fuzzy about how all of that happens.
Well, you need to make sure that your phone is being backed up to the cloud if there's an auto backup. If there isn't, you need to make sure that you're doing it. It's also very useful to spend a bit of time, maybe a couple times a year, selecting your favorite photos and give those some extra attention. We live in an age of excess, lots of stuff, and it's actually much more difficult to preserve huge, huge quantities of things. So if once or twice a year you pick out your favorites, you make sure that you have added notes as to what the occasion was, who the people are, what the date was, and then say you're going to commit to making some extra special effort to those groups of photos, making sure that they're backed up, not just on your phone, but also perhaps on that hard drive, on that cloud service. So that you know that you've got another plan if one of those fails.
Back to the kinds of paper things that, as you say, benign neglect can be good. I know that in my family, I have all of my mother and dad's photo albums that go way, way back. Her family photos that go back to the beginning of the 20th century. We have the old letters. We have, you know, the great uncle's diploma from the Detroit College, which is now the University of Detroit Mercy. But these seem like personal treasures, but truly this is part of our larger history, isn't it?
It's very much part of our larger history. And in the library, we see that many of the important collections that end up in our public libraries and archives actually began as personal collections. They would come into libraries and archives so they'd be available to a wider audience for research.
What's lost if we don't mind our treasures?
Well, what's lost is, first of all, your personal history. These kinds of documents can be very important to a family to understand your personal history, your own sense of identity. So keeping things going from one generation to the next can be very important. And these are things that become the research of the future, and they also become the basic building blocks for all kinds of creativity in the future. Documentaries or the basis for novels or films in the future, the stories that happened to people in the past are frequently the springboard for future creativity.
As a preservation and conservation expert, share some knowledge with the rest of us, things that you do to preserve your family's historic and important details. Particularly, you mentioned cassettes and video tapes and parents' Super 8 films.
Well, first of all, for the paper things, probably the most important thing is not to keep them in the basement and not to keep them in the attic, because very hot, very dry conditions are problematic. Very damp conditions are problematic. And mold can grow very, very quickly and can do a tremendous amount of damage. For the cassettes and the videotapes, at the present stage of things, they really need to be digitized. That is, you need to work with a reputable vendor to transfer them to a digital format that you can then preserve as you would preserve any digital file. Things recorded on magnetic tape are likely to start deteriorating if they haven't already and get to the point where you can't really capture it. So if you have important recordings, particularly from the 70s, 80s, early 90s, those are things that are very important to digitize fairly quickly and keep them then in the digital format.
Get on it. Well, I know you're holding a Preserving History Clinic this coming Thursday at the Hatcher Graduate Library from 4 to 7. And anyone who wants to bring something in has access to your experts.
Absolutely. It is open to the public. It's not a lecture. It's not a workshop. It's an opportunity for people to drop in and talk to an expert one-on-one about their questions, their materials. So bring them.
Bring them. Well, it is really a great effort to just keep our history alive. And you've given me a lot to think about, and everyone else who's listening, about all those things that are in our basements or our attics. Shannon Zachary, head of preservation and conservation at the University of Michigan Library. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Challenge. Opportunities.
The next idea.
Education is not a mechanical system. It's a human system. It's about people.
Why is it that we can summon an Uber with just one click on the smartphone, but if your child is struggling in school, you might not find out for weeks? That is a question Brett Koff is facing head-on with the classroom communication app that he helped to design. It's called Remind. For this MSU grad, the growing success of Remind is especially satisfying because it was born out of his own struggles in school. Brett Koff is here with us now via Skype. Welcome to The Next Idea, Brett.
Thanks for having me.
You're an MSU grad, but you grew up in Illinois. Tell us a little bit about your time growing up in school and some of the struggles you had.
I guess I like to tell people that I started Remind when I was in fifth grade, but that's a blatant lie. The truth is I was diagnosed with a bunch of learning disabilities in fifth grade, and I spent years really struggling in school growing up in northern part of Chicago. When I hit high school, I had this teacher named Miss Whitefield who really changed my life, and my parents were really involved in my education. And so what I realized is, it's not that Miss Whitefield taught me how to be great at math or science or reading. She instilled really meaningful values in me and how to be a good person. And my parents really cared about me getting a good education. And so later in life, when I started Remind, I thought, wow, if we can give every kid a Miss Whitefield, or if we can give them 10 Miss Whitefields, what does the world look like?
Before you found Miss Whitefield, how did those struggles affect the way that you thought of yourself growing up? I mean, there's not a kid in the world that wants to bring a bad report card or a bad test paper home to mom and dad.
Yeah, you know, it was really hard. I felt not smart. I have pretty low self-esteem from it, and I wasn't very confident. I'm definitely more confident now. And it was really difficult, but thankfully my parents knew that I had certain gifts, and they sort of kept pushing me. So there was a small group of people who really cared. And it's not that I was necessarily ashamed about it, like I didn't try. So I would come home with average to below average grades, but I worked really hard at them. And that was the most frustrating thing, is when you try so hard and you really do have good intent, but unfortunately the outcome does not prevail the way you want. So that happening in a repeated cycle started to really kind of wear at my confidence until I got to high school. And when I met Miss Whitefield, that's when things sort of started to change and switch.
What did she do? What was the secret sauce that Miss Whitefield used in kind of changing the way you approach school?
She just really cared, and she was incredibly patient with me. And I really believe that she believed in me. With my disabilities, one of the things that was hard for me in school was comprehending a lot of information quickly in an auditory standpoint. And so if I would hear something without visually seeing it, I was not able to comprehend it, where, I don't know if you want to call it a normal person, but someone without disabilities can hear a recording and they can just comprehend that and spit it back out. I just wasn't able to do it. She was not only patient with me, but she adapted to the style of learning that I needed, which was different from other kids. And she was just really patient. And slowly, slowly, that would just start to build my confidence. It's almost like I had a business partner going at my homework. Like, it wasn't just me alone. And she would never answer the questions for me. But when I would get frustrated, she would just say, like, okay, like, let's just go at it again. Let's just take some time and keep at it. And what ended up happening is my grades would start to improve. But more importantly than my grades, my confidence and the way I was feeling about myself started to improve and get better. And therefore, my grades improved. And that's, I think, the true sign of a successful teacher is not necessarily only grades going up. Sometimes I think that's the only scorecard we use, but it's not the only one. It's that as a human being, I was starting to grow and learn and get more confident and hopefully be a productive member of society when I started to get older.
And you came to Michigan State University. And why did you come to study agricultural economics?
Oh, why? That's a funny question. So, I mean, I went to MSU because I had a bunch of cousins who lived in East Lansing, and I just felt really comfortable there. And I didn't go directly into ag economics. I mean, funny thing, I actually failed economics. I actually had four or five different majors at Michigan State trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I ended up with agriculture because I knew that people would always have to eat. At a basic level, I knew that there would always be a demand for food. It also gave me the opportunity to explore starting companies, which in the end I realized was my life's work. And that's because I like building things. Little did I know at the time, but I like building things that solve problems for a lot of people.
And certainly the company, Remind, the app and company that you co-founded with your brother David, is doing exactly that. Tell us about the app.
Remind is a messaging platform that connects teachers, students, parents, and administrators safely over any device. I started it because I truly did want every kid to have their version of Miss Whitefield. They're using it for a variety of things now. Teachers will use it for motivational messages, reminders. If a kid is failing school, usually Remind is the place where the teacher will message the parent on. We even have students messaging teachers at 7 o'clock at night, taking pictures of their homework assignments and asking for help on it. So it's really a safe, efficient environment where they can communicate, and it works over any device. So we really believe in access. Remind operates in the lowest income districts in the United States. We have 3 out of 10 Title I teachers, meaning they receive funding from the government, actively using the product. And we really care about that. So when I say access, the product works over mobile apps, a website, and text messaging. Even if the student or the parent doesn't have a smartphone, it will work over a feature phone. And we felt like that's important because our vision is to give every student an opportunity to succeed. And that would inherently be impossible if it didn't work over every device and every platform. Today, Remind supports over 20 million active teachers, students, and parents. We'll send over 5 billion messages a year. And about 40% of the United States teachers are actively using the product.
And that's in how many years? When did you actually launch the company?
In 2011, and it's been growing very quickly.
And when I think about what it must be like for your parents who worried their way through school with you as you were trying and you weren't getting the kind of grades that your work should have produced, it has to be a really special thing for them seeing what you're doing for all these other families.
And they were actually the earliest investors in our company. When I was going back and I was saying how naive we were, they were the first ones to put up a little bit of money out of their own pocket, which at the time, in retrospect, looking back, was just crazy. But they did it, and I think they're happy about that. But more so, like you said, I think they're happy to see the outcome with millions of students and parents being impacted by the product.
What grades and levels does Remind cover?
Every grade you could imagine. We support preschool, kindergarten through fifth grade, 6 through 12, and even higher ed. We have thousands of community colleges and universities using us as well. I'd say our sweet spot is definitely grade 6 through 12. And one thing I should clarify, from what I know, third graders don't have phones yet. At least I hope not. So in K-5, it's usually teachers communicating with parents.
And is it something that the school and the district decide we want to bring this in, or can the push to get Remind come from parents and kind of from the ground up?
Yeah, it can really come from anywhere. Usually the way we grow is a teacher will find out about it from another teacher. I believe that's the best type of marketing. It's word of mouth. And they'll sign up in 2 minutes. The product's very simple, which is actually one of our company values because teachers are busy and we never want to create more work from them. We just want to deliver value quickly. And they sign up and they can invite students and parents really quickly. And what ends up happening, the product starts to scale very, very fast. And then we've started to roll out products for administrations at the school and district level so that every constituent in that organization has the features and the product that they need.
What would you say to young people in Michigan who are facing challenges like you did in school and to their parents? How do you hope Remind can make a difference?
Well, I mean, our scorecard is one day hopefully helping teachers eliminate the 8,000 kids that drop out of school every day, which means that we have a long way to go. We've had some modest success, but we have a long way to go. from a student perspective, I hope that they do something that makes them happy and have the time to explore whatever that may be. You know, I think oftentimes people think about college as just a place to go to classes and learn. But just like for me with Miss Whitefield in high school growing up, it wasn't necessarily the learning how to add or learning how to subtract or learning Pythagorean theorem. It was the experiences I had. And so I hope that they have really great experiences in schools and internships and they join clubs because that's when they learn about themselves.
Well, certainly her encouragement lives on in this app that you helped design called Remind. We've been talking with Brett Koff, who is the co-founder and the former CEO of this educational messaging app, Remind. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Brett.
Thanks for having me.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Up next, two Wayne County brothers served 26 years for a murder they didn't commit. Now they could get $1.25 million apiece.
I'd rather have the 26 years back, but that's not possible because there's no price on what we lost.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In summer of 1987, brothers Tommy and Raymond Hires of Flat Rock were arrested, wrongly accused, and convicted of the murder of their pot dealer. It took more than 25 years to prove they were innocent. Today, we conclude our series, Compensating for Lost Time, as we've talked to people who are eligible for compensation from the state for being wrongfully convicted. Last month, after numerous failed attempts in previous legislatures, Michigan became the 32nd state to offer compensation to those who've been wrongfully convicted and exonerated. Those people are now eligible for $50,000 for every year they served in prison, plus other support services. If approved, Tommy and Raymond stand to receive more than $1.25 million apiece, which sounds like a lot, but is it worth over 25 years of your life? I spoke with Tommy and Raymond Hires recently at their attorney's office in Detroit about the long effort to finally clear their names.
Tell us about the crime that you were accused of.
Well, the crime was a marijuana dealer was shot on the east side of Detroit, and there was some car full of kids from Grosse Pointe Shores that went there to cop weed from the drug dealer. And two of them got out the car and went up to the back door. And as they reached the back door, there was four black males that jumped the fence with guns, pointed it at them, and told them to get the frick out of here. As they were leaving, one of the perpetrators walked up to the back door and shot the dude. In the meantime, somebody pulled up and had seen the two get out the car, go to the back door, and then within a minute and a half, they heard the loud boom and seen the two young gentlemen run down the driveway again. Well, he felt they were the perpetrators of the crime, which they were actual almost victims themselves. Then, just, I guess, through our reputations and names, our names got thrown in it, and I was picked out of a lineup. And it was just a horrible mistake of mistaken identity, and it's ruined my life.
Tommy, where were you when all this was going down? Where were you actually?
We was living in Flat Rock, and it was a Friday night. We decided to come down to the city, which we always did, you know, to visit friends and stuff. We were out there working with our stepdad. And on this particular night, we came in, and we went there to Bob's, and we seen police everywhere. You know, we thought he was being raided. That was the only thought that crossed our mind, nothing that, you know, he was hurt or anything. And we just went about our daily, you know, our business after that. And it wasn't until later on that night that we actually heard that somebody was hurt at the house. You know, we still wasn't sure. You know, we didn't know until July 2nd when we were called and asked to come down the homicide for questioning, and we did. And we were never released until 2012.
What was the date when all this happened?
It was June 26th of 87.
So when you think about 26 years for a mistake, what was that like, that moment like, Raymond, when you heard the words after, you know, through this trial, you knew you didn't do it, but you hear the word guilty and then you hear the sentence. What was the sentence you heard?
it's an out of body experience, especially for an innocent man to be in there and then get sentenced to natural life in the state penitentiary without the possibility of parole. And it was like I was sitting there, but I was standing next, and I myself was standing there next to me, just like, and it was just unreal. It was just an out of body experience. You just like, it was over. The main thing was you couldn't understand it. You're innocent, and you never thought that the justice system would let you down like this. And it was just incomprehensible.
Yeah, it was the same for me, too. I just kind of went numb. I heard bells just, and it was like just turning around, looking at all of our families, like not understanding themselves what's going on. You know, everybody's crying and emotional, and here, you know, two kids are going away for life for something they didn't do. And, you know, it was just devastating for us all.
What was a day in prison like for you? What did you do to just keep going? It looked like you weren't going to ever get out. How did you get through each day?
Well, each day was pure hell. Pure hell, knowing that you're innocent and you're still there, but you have to adapt to your situation to survive, to keep your sanity. And the biggest thing was just, I always had the hope, and somehow I knew that there would be a day that we would get out of there, that God wasn't going to let us die in prison for something we didn't do. And that always stayed with me, so I kind of stayed positive. It was just through the grace of God that just gave us that attitude to keep moving forward and not go crazy or not do something, you know, ridiculous in there.
Tommy, were you and your brother together, or were you split up in prison?
We were together for about the first 5 years. And as time went on, there was other things that would happen in other facilities with family members being in the same facility. So eventually they put out a policy that immediate family members could not be housed in the same units. So at that time, they separated us and any other family members that were together at the time.
That must have been tough. What was that like for you?
It was like being sentenced all over again, you know, after, you know, because you got your sibling there, you know, you don't have to question his loyalty or you don't have to question his sincerity, you know what I mean? And just knowing that each of us are innocent, you know, just to have that comfort going through that with, it was a rough time at first. You had to adjust to it, not having him around anymore.
Raymond, who first took up your cause where it ultimately led to your exoneration? When and who?
My brother Thomas.
I would call and just aggravate anybody who I thought would listen. We eventually ended up meeting good people in our life that kind of changed our lives in there, meaning staff members, wardens and deputy wardens, who kind of seen through a lot of things and kind of listened to what we said. And from there, it just seemed like we were on the right track. We got introduced to lawyers who introduced us to investigators and who sincerely tried to help us for many, many years. And, you know, we were creating our own theories about what could have happened and who might have done it. So that's where we spent a lot of our time doing that. I did anyways. And it wasn't until September 9th that we got the letter from Kevin and said he knew of our factual innocence. That's where the ball really got rolling.
Tell us who Kevin is.
Kevin is a lawyer who read Mary Evans' Facebook post, which is with us today. Mary just made a statement on an East Detroit alumni post that she had set up, a site that she had set up, and posted, "Every time I hear Missing You by the Rolling Stones, I think of Tommy Raymond. It's a shame that they're doing life in prison." And after a few weeks of her and Kevin corresponding about other things, he happened to ask, "Why were the Hires brothers incarcerated?" And she explained it to him. Well, unbeknownst to anybody, he actually heard the story before from someone who was actually at the scene of the crime. He heard this in 1994 and didn't realize the significance of it, you know. It wasn't until reading Mary's post and her telling them that they're in there for the murder of old man Bob, and which he thought to himself, it's impossible. If what John Hilscher told me in 94, there's two innocent men in prison.
And who's John?
John was one of the witnesses at the back door. He was one of the ones that walked up from the car to the back door and, you know, witnessed him being shot. When I got the letter of our that he knew of our factual innocence, I mean, you know that he's telling the truth, and you just kind of lose it in hopes that, you know, what he's telling you is, you know, the truth, and this ain't no hoax or game or nothing, you know? It's not every day where somebody tells you this and you actually are. So I kind of believed it right off the bat, you know, just with some of the conversation we had. It wasn't much, but Kevin, you know, got the ball rolling for us eventually.
It does seem, as we hear these stories, that there is that, like, special person that really listened and then took action. And ultimately, you were exonerated, and after 26 years, you walk out. Give me an idea of what that moment was like for you, Raymond, to walk out and know that prison is behind you. What was that like?
It was like being reborn at 47. I mean, the emotions and, I don't know, the emotions, the confusion, and just the reality of being home and, like, wanting to catch up with everything and knowing that you can never catch up with what you lost. And then just the drive just to, you know, go forward. Like, it's done, it's over, and let's just look for tomorrow's.
What were your thoughts, Tommy?
It was nice to get the reversal and have our day in court, which we actually looked forward to. You know, we still had tethers on, ankle bracelets, alcohol tethers on, you know, just anything to make sure that we weren't going too far. Mm-hmm. You know, it was during that time, not knowing, even though we know we're innocent and we know that the judge who released us knows we're innocent, there was always that chance that at another trial that, you know, we could possibly always go back. You know, knowing that wasn't too much of a concern other than really wanting our day in court. I was upset by the fact that they dropped the case like they did and didn't give us that day in court. After 25 years, you know, they claim that they don't have the evidence. Well, all the same evidence exists right now today, this day, 5 years after that. It still exists.
So if you'd been able to have that day in court and get a not guilty verdict versus we can't piece the case together, it would have felt better.
Exactly, right, because that was our mission, to, you know, prove ourselves. We've come a long way for this day, you know, and not to get it was a coward way out on them. And when you look at all the cases that come after us and before us, there's not ever a prosecuting attorney who admits guilt to wrongdoing, even if it's not wrongdoing, just making a mistake. And I think that's where the system needs to be overhauled at, you know, and no one being held accountable for their actions. So many people are convicted under false pretense that the police actually know about but refuse to bring it forward for whatever reason. And those people suffer. But I think our system needs to start, you know, at that phase. And maybe if people start being punished for their actions, they won't do it as much.
Let's talk about this compensation issue. So the two of you spend more than a quarter century in prison, wrongfully convicted, losing years of your life and years of earning power. What did you get to help you out when you left and when you were finally freed?
When we were released, I was 47. So coming out here at 47, starting out like a 20-year-old, trying to build a career with not knowing how long I could work, if I get hurt, what's going to happen to me. Luckily, I got with a good company, Sharon's Heating and Cooling, and they've taught me a trade. And I've been employed with them ever since, and I've been able to purchase a home, cars. But still, I still have the anxiety of losing my job and losing everything I've worked for since I've been home. Mm-hmm. So there's, like, no security for us. I mean, you know, we live check by check, and it could be pulled out from under us any day, and we could be, like, the next person you see out here sleeping on the sidewalk. And that is really scary.
Tommy, parolees in Michigan were getting help with things like, you know, housing and job placement and medical care, but people like you exonerated after spending years in prison unjustly, not one bit of support? Nothing?
No, nothing. You know, we had the help from our attorneys to get with DHS, and they had people come up and, you know, make sure we had the basic medical coming home and food stamps, you know, right off, which helped us out tremendously. Mm-hmm. But after that, you know, you get nothing. So you got to really find a way. And I think the biggest plus for us was that we had our family members, which a lot of people don't have. It's really important for them to be there, because if they're not, then there's really no telling where we would be today. So we accredit a lot of our success to, you know, those family members who were there.
It also occurs to me that you had each other, even though they did split you at some point and sent you to separate prisons, but nobody knows what it's like, but you've got each other. You weren't completely alone and thinking that nobody understands what it feels like. You had each other.
Right. Yeah, it's like we can't even explain it, really. I mean, because you have to walk in them shoes, and the emotions and the shit we deal with, sorry for the language, nobody can understand, and nobody will ever understand. And no matter if we could try to tell you till we were blue in the face, and it would still not cover.
This new law that finally, after a lot of effort and a lot of time, is in effect, grants $50,000 per year spent in prison and reentry services to exonerees like you. I know it's brand new, and there's got to be a process of going through, but let's just say you apply for that compensation and you get that money. What would that mean to your lives, Raymond?
It means security. It means that now I don't have to stress over losing my house, losing my jobs, everything I worked for. And it means that maybe I can help somebody else that's in my situation reach out, because nothing's for free, nothing. If I can help somebody with it, you know, that's innocent or just needs something, you know, it'll make a difference.
What about you? What would you do, Tommy, with that money?
I'm going to do a lot of things. Maybe travel a little bit, something that I've never been able to do, you know, just help out family members that need the help and enjoy it. Like you said, it's security for us, so now we don't have to worry about ever losing everything that we work for out here. I mean, we work hard every single day to, you know, put food on our tables and pay the bills. It's not easy.
But I'd rather have the 26 years back, but that's not possible because there's no price on what we lost.
No. You can't put a dollar amount on 26 years of your life being stored away in a cage.
This has been a pretty long process to get this law passed, with a lot of debating back and forth in Lansing, and you were part of that. How did it feel to hear people who thought this was not a good idea? What was that like for you?
I can remember sometimes, you know, looking over at Val Newman, my attorney. Why is it that some people are so hard to, pressed to believe that this actually happens? If it was their son or daughter, what would you think they would deserve after all that? You know, it'd be a different story then. But you can go anywhere in America and ask anybody, if they spent X amount of years in prison, do they deserve compensation? And 99.9 of them are going to tell you yes. So I just don't understand how the lawmakers and the people who put things in place can't understand that this type of stuff does happen. And especially coming out of Detroit. Look at how many exonerees have come out of Detroit just in the last 3 years since we've been home. It's amazing. It's baffling.
I think it's just, you know, how people say you don't really know it until it touches your life. Yeah. So some, you know, maybe some people can believe it without them touching their lives, but then the other part's like, man, whatever. It don't happen, and, you know, they can just, you know, blow it over their shoulder or whatever. But I don't know. I don't know why it was such a hard fight to get this passed when it's just, it's justice.
Well, we thank you for sharing your story and wish you luck as you continue, you know, reclaiming the lives that were taken away from you for so long. We really want to thank you for sharing your story.
Well, we appreciate you having us.
Thank you.
And that concludes our series, Compensating for Lost Time. We want to say a special thank you to Detroit attorney Gabby Silver for her invaluable assistance in helping us to bring you these stories. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.